funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What would you do if you or a loved one needed an organ transplant to stay alive? About 100,000 Americans a year find themselves in need of donor organs, and for many, there simply is nothing to do other than wait their turn on the frighteningly long list of those in need. But could there be a better way? What might increase the supply of healthy, available organs for those who cannot live without them? And is the American system of caring for critically ill transplant patients as good as it needs to be? Steve Farber is an attorney and founder of the American Transplant Foundation. He happens to be alive today because of a kidney donated by his eldest son, Greg. His new book, co-written with Harlan Abrahams, is called On the List, Fixing America's Failing Organ Transplant System. Steve, welcome to Think.
Well, thank you very much. Happy to be here, Chris.
You had reached a stage in your career, you were in your early 60s, where your money and your influence really allowed you to solve or avoid a lot of problems. But then when you got sick, suddenly you had very little control over your own fate. Can you talk about what that was like?
I'd be happy to. I'm happy to be here so I can talk about it. I was turning 60 and just kind of went to a doctor, my doctor, for a physical. Thought I'd see how healthy I was, and I worked out every day. I ate well, drank very little, and the result of the examination was is I had kidney failure. And the doctor suggested that there was probably very little that they could do other than get me on the list and wait for a transplant.
Now, you had suffered kidney disease as a baby, but for decades you'd felt like you were fine.
I had a kidney ailment called nephritis when I was about 18 months old. And basically I had strep throat that went untreated and undiagnosed, and the kidneys stopped functioning. You either got kidney failure or you got rheumatic fever or something from untreated strep throat, and I went to the Mayo Clinic. After about 4 or 5 months there, they sent me home and told my mother that there was a very little chance that I would live beyond another 30, 60 days. But they did suggest to the people at Children's Hospital in Denver that they knew of a potential, you know, it was a one in a million shot, but if they were able to give me the measles, and the high fever of the measles, they knew of one case where it kicked the organs into functioning. And lo and behold, they put me in the ward with a bunch of children at the measles ward, and they would chew their food, and I would digest it. And lo and behold, as I said, I ended up with the measles, and my kidney started functioning again.
What's really amazing about that story is my understanding is that in the meantime, you have asked a lot of doctors if they've heard of this, and no one has.
No doctor that I've ever talked to has heard it. They give me a look, and they smile, and they say, news to me. But it worked, and, you know, as a little child, they watched me very carefully, and after about 4 or 5 years, I was just like every other normal little kid growing up, playing sports and doing everything that every kid does, and grew up very athletic and never really looked back. It was something that I had when I was a baby, and it left me. So, and then 58 years later, here it was again.
Yeah, fast forwarding back to that time when you found out that your kidneys were not functioning properly, people hear about being on the list. What does that actually mean in practice?
Well, it was the first time that I really thought about it or knew about it was the time that it confronted me. And it took me back when, you know, we read about Mickey Mantle moving up the list to get a liver years earlier. And I said to the doctor, what does this mean? And he said, well, we don't know when your kidney functions are going to really go down anymore, but it could be 6 months, it could be a year, it could be 2 years. But if they get down to the 25-20% level and you don't get a transplant and get on dialysis, you're not going to make it.
And you really didn't want to do dialysis.
Well, I had talked to a few people that, you know, that this was the first time, Chris, that, you know, you're confronted with something like this. I was feeling fine, but I decided that I would start, you know, investigating all the alternatives. Sometimes lawyers do those things. And
due diligence, I guess.
I went to a dialysis clinic, and I watched what people do. You know, three times a week they go on dialysis. They lay there, and it cleanses their system, and they read books, or they read, you know, what they can, or they just lay there. And I talked to a few people I knew that were on dialysis, and they told me the quality of life they had was just horrendous. And while they were on dialysis, it was okay. When they were off dialysis, they just felt terrible. And I kind of looked at myself and looked in the mirror and said, that's not for me. I'm, you know, vibrant, and I'm going to fight this thing. I'm going to eat well and continue to eat well. I'm going to work out every day, and maybe I can just delay it for years.
Steve Farber is my guest. His new book is called On the List, Fixing America's Failing Organ Transplant System. So talk for a minute about how your family reacted to this news. It was, I guess, a shock to everyone who imagined that you would remain as healthy as you had been.
It was a shock, and my wife was in disbelief. She, of course, deals very poorly with medical issues, and she had lost her mother to cancer, and here now her husband was facing, you know, life or death situation in her mind. And but she looked at me and she says, I know you'll figure it out, because you figure it out for all people in your law practice. Somehow you'll figure out what's best and how to take care of it. I took my three boys to Las Vegas and sat them down and said, look, this is what I'm facing. We'll face it as a family and we'll deal with it together, but I need your support. And well, I'll keep you guys informed and talk to you as we go through this thing. So, you know, I made a full disclosure to the family. It's kind of interesting because you get out there and you feel like you're on an island by yourself. And everybody, you know, is thinking what's best for you, but you're not dealing with it in the way that you would normally deal with it, because your mind is dealing with 10 different things at once.
I want to take a sideline here. The book also tells the story of a family that was in very different financial circumstances, at least, but facing a similar kind of crisis. Will you tell us about Ernesto and Sandra?
Yeah, this is the De La Roca family. They came to the United States from Guatemala, happened to be in a room next to me. We got to know them because I received a lot of flowers and baskets, and suggested to my wife that I don't need all the flowers and baskets. Take them down the hall and share them with other people, you know, on the same floor that are going through these transplants. And they went in the De La Roca room and gave them a lot of flowers, and suddenly built up a conversation with them and found that they had come to the States after their parents were taken away by the military, and they've never seen them again. And here was Ernesto dealing with his little sister again. Saved her life once in the jungles, and he was saving her life again by giving her a kidney. And she had been on dialysis and was doing very, very poorly and really needed a transplant in order to survive. We both went on the list. The list in Colorado at that time was about a 3.5-year wait. And every state has a different time period, you know, and it's the availability of organs that's going to ultimately, if a cadaveric kidney becomes available and you're next in line, you get it. The system of the list has a lot of integrity in it. The biggest problem we have is we don't have enough organs available to the people that are on the list. Today, we have 103,000 people on a list waiting for kidneys and livers. And 18 people die every day waiting because the lack of availability of organs.
Now, I suppose the one good thing about needing a kidney transplant is that this is an organ that you can also take from a living donor. We all have, most of us who are healthy, have two kidneys and can survive quite well on just one.
Correct. You know, I was very fortunate that after I told my sons the story, they all went to be checked by doctors to see what the blood type is and the antigen match. There's six antigens that they check, and if you have a one antigen match, then it's usually a match. In my case, my oldest son was the first one checked. He had a six antigen match, which is a perfect match. And it's very highly unlikely that you're going to get a perfect match from a son to a sibling, it's more likely that the children would match each other in that match.
Now, it would seem for people on the outside of the situation that, great, your son was a good match, problem solved. But this is sort of a gut-wrenching thing to go through, even when you have a willing donor.
It's the toughest decision I ever made. First of all, I had a son who was willing and wanting to do it. And as he said to me, he said, look, Dad, if you ask me whether I want to just go have surgery, the answer is no. And if you ask me whether I just want to give up an organ, the answer is no. But if you ask me whether I want to save your life, the answer is yes. And I said, Greg, I appreciate, you know, your thoughts and being there for me, and it sure gives me a sense of security knowing that at the end of the day, if that's my only alternative, I'll take it. But I sure don't want to put you under a scalpel and under the knife and subject you to, you know, any potential harm. And plus, he was a very athletic kid, still is, by the way. And I don't want to, you know, he plays football, he plays basketball, plays baseball, he played baseball in college. And I don't want to take away any activity that you can do. Why should I limit your life? Let me see if there's an alternative. And that's where we started seeking potential alternatives. I had a lot of friends that came to me and said that they wanted to donate their kidney organ. But as they got checked and the doctors talked to me about friends my age, they said, do you want a 68-year-old kidney? You know, you want a kidney that's going to last a while. And, you know, you may want to wait for a cadaveric. I heard that there were other countries where they had gray market kidneys. So, for instance, Turkey. There was a doctor in Turkey, and I spoke to the doctor. And he said, for $100,000, you know, we'll do the transplant. We'll get you the kidney. You don't have to worry about a thing.
Now, what they don't say in these interactions is that they are purchasing this kidney from somewhere. But that's sort of understood by everybody involved.
Well, it was kind of understood by me. And I asked the question. I said, where do you get the kidney? And he said, well, you know, when you send me $100,000, that covers everything. And I said, I started doing a little bit of research, for instance, in Turkey, and found that it was a gray area, but most likely illegal. And that troubled me a lot as being a lawyer. Number one, the morality of taking someone's kidney that they had purchased troubled me. Number two, I couldn't get the movie Midnight Express off my out of my head. I don't know if you're old enough or to have seen that movie, but it was a frightening movie for our generation, and that's my generation, when it came out probably 30-plus years ago. And it was about a young man who was arrested in Turkey for smuggling and put in a Turkish prison and ended up spending about 8 years in this Turkish prison.
You were afraid you might get caught having done this sort of gray deal and not be allowed to leave the country.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And once they said to me, by the way, you won't tell anybody why you're coming here, it just sat in my mind. I just knew I couldn't go to Turkey to do this thing. And in fact, a number of years back, after my transplant, the doctor was arrested and some other patients were arrested in Turkey and put into jail.
Steve Farber is my guest. He is an attorney and founder of the American Transplant Foundation. His new book is called On the List, Fixing America's Failing Organ Transplant System. We'll come back to our conversation in a moment. You can get on the line to join us by calling 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's informal courses for adults. Short courses in the arts, writing, languages, history, and communication start weekly in September. You can learn something new. Details at smu.edu/think.
You're You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is attorney Steve Farber, who is founder of the American Transplant Foundation. His new book is called On the List, Fixing America's Failing Organ Transplant System. You can join us by sending email to think at KERA.org or by calling 1-800-933-5372. Steve, one of the things that really frustrated you as you started to investigate this whole thing is the fact that many people are under the assumption that it is completely illegal to buy or sell organs or human tissue in this country. In fact, that's not the case. You simply can't sell the ones that would save someone's life.
Well, Chris, let me clarify. It is the federal law that you cannot sell organs or pay any consideration. It may not be money, it may be in kind, but it's illegal to receive or to pay any consideration for an organ that is going to be used in transplantation. You can, however, sell or receive consideration on an organ if it's for research. So if you're selling an organ to save a human life, it's illegal. It's a felony. If you're selling an organ to a company for medical research, it's permissible.
You can sell things like sperm and human eggs.
Correct.
Mm-hmm. Talk for a minute. I mean, obviously there are ethical questions in places, including the Philippines, where it is legal to buy and sell kidneys. The concerns there are that people do this out of desperation and without fully understanding the consequences. What's your take on that?
I agree with it. And I think what it does is it benefits the wealthy. So it puts the wealthy in a position of being able to purchase organs. It doesn't create any equality with people that can't afford it. And unless you have a provision for people that can afford it, then treat people equally, again, you lose the integrity in the system. And then you have people selling it that could be taken advantage of. And it's the same thing in the Philippines as well as Iran. I think they're the two countries that have the free market system. And I'm not advocating for a free market system in this country, because you would have a greater availability of organs. What I've advocated for in the book and what our foundation has tried to push forward is, number one, a greater awareness so we can create a greater number of contributions. And Senator Arlen Specter has proposed in the U.S. Senate is that let's get the states the right to compensate people that become organ donors. As living donors, you know, it's interesting because we're dealing with this healthcare crisis, and the answer has been there, let's provide insurance for everyone. Well, if we provide an incentive of insurance to people to become organ donors, then they're getting something for it. And it would be the states that would be providing the compensation. So you'd have the compensation in kind of health insurance or of life insurance. If it's a cadaveric donation, then you have the compensation of paying for burial expenses, things that are not being dealt with today. And that's kind of the economic approach that we're pushing.
What do we know right now about what motivates people either to decide that upon their death they'll be a donor or that they do not want to be a donor?
Well, first of all, and I'm sure it's the same in Texas as it is in Colorado, that when you're a certain age, 16 or 15, whatever it is in the various states, you go get your driver's license. And it's the first time that you're approached when asked, saying, would you like to be an organ donor? And to ask a 15-year-old or 16-year-old whether, you know, that's what they'd like to do, I'm not sure that they have the awareness nor they've thought through it. And if they're with their parent, the last thing the parent wants to think about at that time when they're getting their child the license or with them is organ donation, God forbid. So it's a time where it hits you that maybe you're not mature enough or that you have the right judgment necessarily to decide that on your own. And so if your parents are going to push you, that's how it is. And then it's years later where you ever go back to motor vehicle. So there are so many people that from the time they're 16 to the time they're 50 don't even think about it again. What we did in Colorado, and that was one of the reasons we created the foundation, I said to a lot of people, including my maker, that if I get through this, I'm going to do something because I haven't done enough yet. And we went to the head of the Department of Revenue and suggested that there might be another way to get this in front of people. And we were able in Colorado to have it put on the tax return. So when you file your tax return on the form every year in Colorado, it has a place to become an organ donor if you're not. And again, it's creating the opportunity, not only the awareness, but the opportunity to become one.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can also reach us via email to think@kera.org. Let's go to Highland Village now and speak with Bill. Hi, Bill.
Hello. Hello.
Hi,
hello,
go
Bill.
Ahead, please.
I have two steps to be very easy, which I think would generate a lot of extra organs. One would be on that on your driver's license. If you don't care enough to check the box one way or the other, reverse the default. If you don't say, don't take my organs, then they are by default available. Second one is if you don't bother making your organs available, then you don't get any kind of special favors on the organ list. If you wouldn't have given yours, then don't expect somebody else to push you to the top of the list.
Well, Bill, those are two very good suggestions, and they're dealt with in the book that we wrote on the list. The first one really is called the opt-out plan or an implied consent plan. In other words, everybody is an organ donor unless they decide they sign not to be an organ donor. We've received a lot of opposition to that, and one country has tried it, and it really didn't increase the number. But it is definitely a theory that we've considered, and I think it would work. I mean, I can't see how it would create a lesser number. And I also believe that it would be a reward for those people that are already registered organ donors to move up the list a lot faster.
There have been cases in the past, I know, where people actually opted in as donors, and then upon their sudden death, family members just really did not want this and were able to sort of veto that idea. Are those laws starting to change across the country so that if one has opted to be an organ donor, no one can get in the way of that?
Chris, that's another great point and something we dealt with. We've changed the law in Colorado so that if the person, the cadaver, the person who died, was an organ donor and elected to be an organ donor, that the hospitals and doctors shall respect that decision and the family veto wouldn't apply. The biggest issue, however, is when you get in a room and the hospitals are there and the family is saying, we don't want our child or our relative to be an organ donor, people worry about lawsuits. But the law in Colorado today is very clear that to honor the wishes of the organ donor.
I believe the law in Texas is similar, but I wasn't able to look that up this morning. Can you talk about, you mentioned compensation for people and potentially paying funeral expenses. Where would that money come from? Would it come from the recipient or would it come from an insurance company?
It would probably come from an insurance company through the state. The states, each state would, have their own plan and would figure a way to finance it. Because in the long run, the more organ donors you have, the less cost you're going to have ultimately on the state.
Sure, for long-term care.
Exactly.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Steve Farber is my guest. His new book is called On the List, Fixing America's Failing Organ Transplant System. Let's go next to ULIS, where we'll speak with Raza. Hi, Raza.
Hi, Chris. I love the show. I've listened to you quite frequently.
Thank you.
First of all, Mr. Farber, congratulations to you for coming out of the hemodialysis system because I'm a clinical certified hemodialysis technician, and I'm in contact with these patients, every time I go at work, and, my heart goes out to these people because what they have to face is just, I don't think anybody can really imagine. My question to you, sir, is in your book, were you able to research the new technology of gene therapy or cloning technology for us to kind of, have much better luck with anterior ejection problems with the kidneys, because most of the time, a lot of people, once getting their kidneys, they would start taking their anterior ejection drugs, and that would eventually lead to the, going bad of the new kidney that they have just received.
I appreciate your calling in, and I appreciate your question. We do discuss that in the book, and I dealt with it personally. When I sat down with the counselors, I asked them, what's the longevity of these organs surviving? You know, what's the average? And when they start telling you the averages, you get a little bit alarmed, because in a cadaveric transplant, it's like 8 to 13 years, and in a living donor, it's a little bit more. And I said, that's not very long. And I think what happens is there are, just like you said, there are people that stop taking the anti-rejection medication for various reasons. You really have to be regimented to do this. There were 8 pills I took every morning, 8 pills I took every night. And I'm now down about 5 in the morning and 5 at night. But I don't skip, a day. I'm pretty religious about doing that, because it's my health and my life. Also, I've heard that a lot of the, as people get older, the insurance doesn't cover the medication, and it's very expensive. I've not known that in my case, for instance, or other people that I know, but I've heard that that has occurred. Well, that if in fact the insurance companies don't cover the full amount of the pay for the medication, and people can't afford it, that's the net result. But there are also new researches going on too. For instance, the bone marrow. If somebody becomes a donor, living or not, and they can also transplant the bone marrow, that bone marrow will serve as the anti-rejection medication, basically, because the body will be telling the system and the kidney that it's still the same body, and it would be less likely to be rejected. That's really been researched a lot lately. I don't believe that it's been put into practice yet, that they're ready to do it.
So the idea is sort of a dual transplant, whatever other organ you need, and bone marrow from the same donor.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Let's go next on the phones at 1-800-933-5372 to Jeannie in Dallas. Hey, Jeannie.
Hi. Let me take the speaker. Hi. My question is also about the new technology. Sorry for referencing another program. Dr. Oz, who puts a lot of new things out there for Oprah, was doing an expose on some of the research in where they're actually taking stem cells from an individual. It's not from an embryo. It's some of your stem cells, making this soup, and then it's poured over a mold that's actually in the shape of the organ, and they're growing organs using your cells so that you don't actually have to take rejection medication. And so I'd just like to hear if you've heard about that or any comments about it.
I have heard about it. In fact, I talked to Congresswoman DeGette in Colorado here, who just wrote a book on stem cell research and has been the major advocate in Congress getting stem cell research supported by the federal government. And we were talking exactly about this, that it won't be long where organs will be created by use of the stem cells. They're doing it today in laboratories, and they've given me 5 to 10 years where it'll be a reality.
And is this happening? Is it more successful with embryonic stem cells, or are adult stem cells that are used in this way equally effective?
I think it's the adult stem cells that they're using in terms of the formation of new organs.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. We'll go next to Fort Worth and speak with Tom. Hello, Tom.
Good afternoon. My question for Mr. Farber, I'm aware of a lot of people who are hesitant to become organ donators because they have concerns about perhaps not just the kidney or the heart or the liver being harvested for use for patients on the list, but perhaps everything else then being utilized for research and for various other purposes. And I think there's a line of willingness there, and I'm interested to hear your guests' observations on that.
Well, Tom, thanks for the question. The input that I get from most people who aren't organ donors, and it's not a religious issue, it's an issue of, will people be more apt to declare you brain dead so that they can harvest the organs before, in fact, you are? And I'm not aware, you know, there have been a number of cases raised where, in fact, people have said that. It was a rush to harvest the organs rather than to treat the patient. But, you know, I don't see that, in fact, is reality in most cases.
Can you talk for a minute about kidney swaps and how those take place?
Well, yeah. I mean, kidney swaps now have been determined to be legal. And let's define kidney swaps. Let's assume, Chris, you and I are married, and I need a kidney, but you don't match me. But there's another couple where, in fact, the wife would be a good match for me, and you would be a good match for the husband in terms of organ donation. That will not be deemed to be the consideration that would violate the law in terms of a kidney swap.
So, in other words, if everybody's willing to do it this way, it's perfectly acceptable.
That's been acceptable, determined to be acceptable. Correct.
Steve Farber is my guest. He is an attorney and founder of the American Transplant Foundation. His new book is called On the List, Fixing America's Failing Organ Transplant System. If you want to be part of the conversation, give us a call at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's informal courses for adults. Short courses in the arts, writing, languages, history, and communication start weekly in September. You can learn something new. Details at smu.edu/think.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is attorney Steve Farber, who is founder of the American Transplant Foundation. His new book is called On the List, Fixing America's Failing Organ Transplant System. We have an email to think@kera.org from Laura in Dallas, who reminds us that the website to become a donor in Texas is donatelifetexas.org. It's a simple form, she says, takes less than 5 minutes to complete. I have done it, and in fact, that is the case. So it's very simple if you're thinking about this right now to take action as we speak. If you'd like to join the conversation on the phone, the number is 1-800-933-5372. We'll go next to Gary in Flower Mound. Hi, Gary.
Hi there. Steve, I first of all want to say thank you very much for being on this program. It's very informative. I am a double lung recipient 3 years ago, December of 06. I got a double lung transplant. And as you know, life is wonderful. Two quick comments. One is, in Texas, when you go up and you go up Donate Life Texas, as I just talked about, .org, it's the Glenda Dawson registry, Texas registry. You'll also become a member then of the UNOS list, the national list, of course, at the same time. In Texas, the state attorney general has issued an opinion that that is a legal document and that the family cannot override it if you are, in fact, on the list. Second thing is, I disagree with the philosophy that a 15 or 16-year-old person is not old enough, mature enough to make a decision of this nature as whether or not they want to be organ donors. I speak to a lot of groups working with the Southwest Transplant Alliance Corporation here to make organ donor awareness programs and so forth, and the young people look at it more of a, yes, that would be a wonderful gift that I can give should I die. So, sure, I'll sign up for it. that tends to be the general reaction from these people. And that's really all I wanted to comment on, unless you had something you wanted to ask me about that.
Oh, Gary, I'm glad you're doing well and your double transplant is working. And, you know, stay well and keep taking the anti-rejection medication. And, you know, as people, as I say to people when they ask me in the morning, how do you feel? Whether I feel good or bad, I make up my mind that I feel good. And I'm working hard and I work out every day. And feel as good as I did long before the transplant. So stay well yourself.
We should talk for a minute about the fact that, you know, we've talked about cadaver donations and occasionally families have conflicting ideas about this. It can also happen with a living donor. And your wife in particular was really opposed to the idea of, although he was 31 at the time, of her baby boy going through this surgery, even to save your life.
Well, let me clarify one thing. All her boys are her baby boys.
Of course, yeah.
I understood the love of a mother for her children, and I had the same love for my children as she did, and that's why I pursued other avenues. It wasn't just because she was kind of against my son becoming a donor. I was against it too because I wanted an alternative. And it's interesting, there was a doctor friend I ran into at a restaurant, and I'm sure you remember this from the book. And he said, you haven't done the transplant yet because you don't look very good. That's not what he said. He said it's stronger. And I said, yeah, you're right. And he said, I heard your son is a perfect match. Have you thought about what will happen if you don't take his kidney and you don't make it, the guilt that you're putting on him the rest of his life? And that probably more than anything in making a decision, I hadn't even put that in, you know, digested that. And I went home that night and called my son, and I said, are you still there? Because I'm not going to Turkey, and I'm not going anywhere else. I appreciate your being there, and I'm ready to call the doctor and tell him we're ready to do it. So it was, you know, understanding what my wife was saying, and it wasn't that we were at odds at all. It was, I respect how you look at it. I look at it the same way, and I hope we find another alternative.
On the other hand, Steve, did you feel any sort of ethical tug in terms of the fact that if you do have a willing donor who will give you a perfect match kidney, is it your ethical obligation to accept that as opposed to taking a cadaver kidney that might in fact go to someone else who didn't have a willing donor?
You know, Chris, I thought about that, and, you know, it very similar to the thought of adoption, mm-hmm. You know, where people have children, but yet they want to adopt another child. Aren't you really taking that child away from somebody else, you know, who can't have children? And, you know, that was my belief on adoption, and I guess in some respects, I recognize the issue, but I'm not sure that I'm 100% there.
Yeah, there are a lot of really complicated questions in this whole affair. Steve Farber is with us. The number is 1-800-933-5372. Let's go next to Elaine in Dallas. Hi, Elaine.
Hi.
Hello,
Chris.
Elaine.
Hi, Steve. I wanted to clarify that I recently renewed my driver's license online, which was an option, and it brought up the question of whether I would like to be an organ donor, which I agreed, and within a week or so, I had my organ donor card and information in the mail. I still don't have my renewed driver's license, but I did want to let you know that that was available. It's the first time I've renewed online, so I don't know how long that's been an option, but it certainly works for me.
Well, great. Well, thank you for becoming an organ donor or opting at least into the system.
Yeah. Let's go next to Brian in Fort Worth. Hey, Brian.
Hi there. Thanks for accepting my call.
Sure.
And Steve, I just wanted to say this is a great story. It's very inspiring, and you brought up a great conversation. My question is, and I don't want this to become some political conversation, but I wanted to get your opinion, Steve, on how you think an organ donation system that we currently have in the U.S. may change if we go to a nationalized healthcare in the face of a probable and possible need to rationalize healthcare in a situation like that.
That's a very, it's again, as Chris said, one of these very thought-provoking discussions that we could have probably for hours, Brian. I haven't given it as much thought as I probably should because I'm dealing with the existing system. I'm also trying to deal with the health care reform that we're all going through, just like all Americans are, you know, trying to think through it, how it impacts them. I have really not given it the analysis how it would impact the system itself.
We should say there are already some parameters set for who is allowed to be placed on the list. Not everyone who is critically ill can, in fact, qualify for a donated organ.
That's correct. Mm-hmm. If you're a diabetic, it will impact the decision as to whether they put you on the list or not. Because what's happening is, again, this comes back to another question you asked, Chris. You'd be taking an organ from somebody else who doesn't have diabetes and might, you know, be giving them life for 10, 15 years, or in fact, the person with diabetes may only be extending their life for another 3 or 4 until diabetes takes over the kidney again.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. We'll go next to Caitlin in Denton. Hello, Caitlin.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
It's really been fascinating.
Hi, Caitlin.
Hi. My question is, has it been talked about in the medical community at all to harvest the organs of the executed on death row before they're being executed?
This is happening or being prevented now in China.
I just heard about that yesterday on All Things Considered, I think, and I was just wondering if, I mean, I think it's a pretty good idea. They can give back something back to the community. They can be tested. Seems like it would be a lot more organs floating around if they thought about that.
Now, Caitlin, you raise a good point. We are aware of what's going on in China. In this country, I don't believe that it's been, to my knowledge, at least in Colorado, it's not been raised as an issue. So it's something I will pursue, and I appreciate you bringing it up.
We should point out to people who think about this as a sort of a great solution that the pool of potential donors, even if they were consenting donors who were being executed, is quite small in the United States as compared with the number of people who need organs.
Right. And it was raised in China, I believe, because of some people from the States went to China to receive a kidney or liver.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. We'll go next to Arlington and speak with Ray. Hey, Ray.
Hi. I wanted to ask your guest if he did any research into cultural ideas about bodily integrity, especially in terms of death, because when you die, you no longer need your organs. So I'll take my answer off the air.
Thanks.
Well, Ray, we talked to a number of people, religious leaders and others, in terms of finding out what's the moral issue that's raised in various religious sects. For instance, in dealing with Orthodox Jews, for many years they discouraged people from becoming organ donors. In fact, today they have changed that stand, many of them, because giving somebody life is a much greater moral purpose than dealing with the desecration issues.
Yeah, and there have been other faiths that have sort of shifted their position in favor, not all of them, but in favor of promoting organ donation.
Correct.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Pam in Dallas. Hi, Pam.
Hi. I know you're about out of time. I'm not sure if the retina is considered an organ, but does your guest know anything about retina transplants and if this is a possibility?
I know you can donate corneas.
Yeah, I know about the cornea transplants, Pam. In fact, as they say, if you become an organ donor, the cornea is one of the organs that they view as a transplanted organ. So they say the impact of becoming an organ donor can save 10 to 15 lives and impact about 30 or 40 lives from the cornea transplants.
800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go to David in Dallas. Hi, David.
Hello.
Hi,
Hello,
David.
David.
Hi. This is my question. I'm 61, and when I was a young man, I used to donate blood all the time. Then I got to be a member of the 10-gallon club. And then I was exposed to hepatitis, and I couldn't donate blood anymore. Can I still donate other things? Has medical science figured out how I can donate to somebody who parallels me? Thanks.
David, I would ask the question of whether the hepatitis was hepatitis C. Because if, in fact, it was hepatitis C, then there would probably be an issue in terms of being a donor. If it was one of the other hepatitis that was cured, I imagine that you would probably clear the list. But, you know, different doctors have different views on those things.
What have you seen a change in the way people understand this issue? Not even necessarily a question of willingness, but are more Americans sort of aware of what this really means?
I think there's a much greater awareness today than there was 5 years ago and than there was 10, 20 years ago because there are a lot of celebrities who are getting transplants from George Lopez to Natalie Cole to Stephen Kuchikaru and basketball players who are back playing again. And it's on the front page of the paper. You have Stephen Jobs from Apple getting his liver transplant. You have the most recent articles of people, you know, buying and selling organs. It's just something that's moved from, you know, a small article somewhere on page four to front page you know, information, and I think because of that, there's a much, much greater awareness. I think there's, a, you know, 30 years ago, you'd be lucky to be living after you had a, you know, kidney failure.
Yeah, the technology itself is less than half a century old.
That's exactly right.
Are you able to be an organ donor now, given your health history?
Probably not. I assume the cornea transplant would be good, but I'm not sure. The kidney, you know, or, you know, it probably could be a heart donor. And we'll definitely make sure that I, you know, am on the list, but to be a donor. But they'll have to decide at that point in time whether they want any of my organs. I hope I'm around a long, long time, Chris, just like you. And they won't want my organs because I'm too old.
Well, we'll all hope for that. Thank you so much. Steve Farber is an attorney and founder of the American Transplant Foundation. His new book is called On the List, Fixing America's Failing Organ Transplant System. Steve, it's been very interesting. Thank you so much for joining us.
Chris, thanks for having me on.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.